Good evening, everyone. It is about 7 p.m. on Thursday, June 29th, 2006. This is the time and the place that we noticed in our fourth scheduling and procedural order to receive additional public input comment, and if people out there so choose, offer testimony in the case. The case I'm talking about is the application of Otter Tail and its associated companies for a permit to construct the Big Stone 2 coal-fired electric generating station just outside Big Stone City, South Dakota, in the northeast part of South Dakota. Many of us in the room have spent the last 4 days in the formal contested case portion of this proceeding, where we've taken a huge amount of factual evidence into evidence, and the commissioners will need to make a decision on the basis of that evidence. I want to emphasize that there are, in addition to the straight factual findings in a case like this, there are also, in effect, policy decisions within the parameters of the law that the commissioners need to make in every case, and they're going to have to do that here. And one purpose of taking public input testimony is so that the public can give us your views as to when there's a gray area or a close call or an ambiguity or whatever in the law, some leeway that you can let us know how you think the commissioners ought to look at this case. And that's one of the purposes I think we want to try to fulfill tonight, or give you the opportunity to have that input into how the commissioners should view this case. We noticed the proceeding under a particular rule of ours, which allows persons to appear in a case and be heard. And basically what I think we've decided, and we provided, that you may be subject to cross-examination. I don't know that everyone out there in the audience wants necessarily to be a fact witness in the contested case proceeding, or whether your input tonight is more in the nature of policy or philosophical type positions that you just feel you want the commissioners to hear. And the way I think I'm going to break it down is this. If what you want to do is just make comments that are in the nature of philosophy, policy, just giving your views to the commission, we're not going to swear you, and you're not going to be subject to cross-examination. The downside of that is we will also then not be considering your testimony here tonight as part of the hard factual record in the case. It will be treated as comment. If you want what you say tonight to be treated as fact evidence in the case, then please let me know that. And then we're going to swear you as a witness. And there's various attorneys in the room that have been here for several days, and they will have the opportunity then to cross-examine you about particular factual statements that you may make. I don't know, I guess before we begin, do the commissioners have any objections to that mode of operation? I'm going to note for the
Mr. Smith, I don't have an objection. I just might note that this has not been the only opportunity for public input. There was a public input session this commission had at Millbank some number of months ago. There's also been a written comment period. And so we've wanted to solicit as much public input as possible. And certainly whatever you say tonight, even if you choose only to make commentary and not be a sworn witness, we'll certainly – that information certainly enters our brains and is important to us as well.
Maybe, commissioners, before we start, would you like to introduce yourselves for the audience?
My name is Bob Saar. I'm the chairman of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission, and I just want to say thank you for everyone that came here tonight, and we appreciate your input into the process.
Dusty Johnson.
I'm Gary Hansen.
And I'm John Smith, and I'm the real John Smith. And you're like a walking joke, you know, but it, at any rate, I'm the general counsel of the commission, and in in contested case hearings, I generally serve as the hearing examiner, which I'm going to do tonight. And with that, we will open the hearing. I'll note for the record that we have received several written comments thus far. Those comments are accessible on our website, and I'll have to try to remember the URL. You probably all know it already, but it's www.puc.sd.gov. And those written comments are under this particular docket page on our website, which you find at Commission Actions, Commission Dockets, 2005 Electric Dockets, and then scroll down to EL05-022. And most of the comments we've received, in fact, all of them, have been within the last couple weeks, written comments, that were not included, at least in the earlier Milbank public meeting proceeding. And so you may see what on the website what everybody out there has submitted in writing, and I encourage you to do that. At this point, I guess I would like to open up the hearing tonight, and I'm not quite sure how to go about this. I guess what I'll do is just open it up and allow persons who wish to speak to raise your hand or to come up to the witness stand here and take it from there.
Mr. Smith, might it make sense to have all those people wishing to offer public comment to go first? Or do you not mind having
why don't we do that? Why don't we allow anybody who wishes just to give comment to go first, and that way, if there are people who want to be here and subject themselves to cross-examination and go on and on with this, well, then the other people can decide whether they want to
don't
hear about that.
Make it sound too entitled.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No. Does anyone in the audience want to give public comments?
I'll volunteer to go first.
Well, I wanted to cross-examine you.
You're not going to get that chance.
And Mayor, if you would, please, just a friendly reminder, and this goes for everyone in the audience. We have a number of people that have been listening in on the Internet, and the one of the challenges is with the witness microphone, you have to be very close to it. So if you and the other people who intend to speak tonight could pull it close, we sure would appreciate it. And we know our friends on the Internet would because they've had trouble hearing witnesses otherwise. So thank you very much, Mayor.
Mayor Eznick, one more announcement before you start, and I apologize. I really do. I just wanted to remind everybody that in the fourth scheduling order, we did establish the deadline for written comments as 5 o'clock tomorrow, June 30th. And so I'd just like to remind everybody in the audience, and particularly the people online who couldn't be here, that if you want your comments included in the record in this case, we need to have them. We just have to have a cutoff sometime because we have a very short time frame before we're required by statute to render a decision in the case. And so we need to know at some point what's in the file and what we're dealing with. Pardon me, Mayor Eznick, please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the commission, it is a pleasure for me to be here tonight on the other side of the table. It's been a while since I've been with the group of PUC people, and this is an unusual place for me to be, but it's a pleasure to be here. And I'm here tonight with some very brief comments, understanding that you have put in a long week with your evidentiary hearing. But I wanted to make some comments tonight about the relationship between the City of Pierre and the Missouri River Energy Services, which, as you know, is one of the partners of the proposed Big Stone plant. Pierre is one of 12 cities in South Dakota that is a member of the MRES. And as that, the Missouri River Energy Services actually provides the supplemental power for Pierre and those other 12 cities over and above what our hydro allocation is. And because of the fact that Pierre, and along with a lot of the other communities in South Dakota that are members, do have some growth. You know, our community here in Pierre has had about a 3% steady growth over the past decade. And because of that, our electrical demand continues to grow. And as you know, our hydropower is limited. And the additional energy that we get is coming from Missouri River Energy Services. And right now, one of the bigger baseload plants that Missouri River Energy Services is involved in is the Laramie River Station at Wheatland, Wyoming. And because of the growth that we have had on our system, Missouri River Energy Services, it is time now that we look to the future so that we can continue to supply the low-cost, stable power, stable rates for those members that belong to MRES. And really, that's why I'm here. And we are very, very pleased, I guess, that Missouri River Energy Services has chosen to become a partner in the Big Stone plant for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's in South Dakota, and we like that. That's good economic development for our state. Second of all, I am very pleased about the philosophy that Missouri River has had as far as the environmental philosophy they have when they're looking for additional power. And the Big Stone Power Plant, from what I have read, is going to be a very environmentally sound plant that will be as environmentally responsible with the additional new plant as it is right now, which means that there's going to be some major things that are done as far as environmental control. So I'm pleased about that, and I think all of us that live in South Dakota should be pleased about that. One of the other things that I think you should know, that as a member of Missouri River Energy Services, we belong to an organization that really has a better record, I would think, than most organizations do as far as having environmentally clean power. And that is because of the fact that about 50% of the power that is supplied to those members comes from the hydropower. And the baseload plants that we've got, the one over in Wyoming is a very environmentally sound plant, and we know that the Big Stone one is going to be also. In addition to that, Missouri River has taken on some wind energy projects, the biggest one, which is over in Worthington, Minnesota. And they also supply additional power into our system. One of the other things that I have read about that I'm particularly interested in, having sat on the other side of the table here, is part of the project with Big Stone is to do some upgrades to the regional transmission system. And all of us that have been involved in electric transmission know that probably the biggest barrier to doing something here in South Dakota, whether it's baseload plant, whether it's wind energy, whatever it might be as alternative sources of energy, is being able to get that to the market and on the grid. And without transmission, we have a barrier. So as part of this, there are some upgrades that are going to be done, and I think that's fantastic. So in closing, I just want to urge you to support the siting of the Big Stone plant. I think it's not only good for communities like Pierre, but it's outstanding for the state of South Dakota as far as economic development is concerned. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I should note, certainly it was implied in some of our comments and in your comments, Mayor, but not only are you the mayor of Pierre, but you're also a former commissioner on this commission, and we really appreciate you coming here tonight and welcome you back to a setting. Even if you're on the other side of the table, you probably know quite well. So thank you.
Thank you,
Bob. And if as you step forward, if you'd say your name and if you have any particular affiliation or town that you come from, that'd be great.
My name is Jeff High, and I'm the general manager at Watertown Municipal Utilities, and it seemed like a good time to tag along with the other MRES member, Pierre. Like Pierre, we are...
Jeff, if I may, do you need the spelling of his last name? And his first name, too. That's a good point. Sorry.
Thank you. Like Pierre, we're one of the 12 members of in South Dakota that are members of Missouri River, and as such, we receive our supplemental power from Missouri River to meet our growth. Watertown is the largest municipal electric system in South Dakota. We serve 12,000 electric customers, and we're also the fastest-growing community in the in the 60 members of the Missouri River family in the four states that they operate in. We're continuing to grow and develop. In the past few years, we've seen an increase in population, business development, the completion of an ethanol plant within the city limits of Watertown, a plastics manufacturing plant, a new event center, and anyone, of course, who goes along Interstate 29 is starting to see an awful lot of commercial growth near Watertown in that area. Our electric load growth has averaged more than 5% per year over the last 20 years. Our total demand has more than doubled in that time. And our total energy sales has actually gone higher than that. Our load factor has actually gained in that time. So our electric load growth, we're planning on load growth of 2007 of 10% in 1 year alone. We will use up 7 megawatts of Missouri River's 150 megawatt allocation from the Big Stone 2 plant just next year alone in Watertown. We're going to continue to seek economic development. We've been a little pretty lucky at that, bringing new jobs, industry, and citizens to the community. But in order to do that, as you can see, we need a reliable and energy efficient source of power. In order to meet these demands and the demands of its other members, of course, Missouri River has joined the participants in the Big Stone 2 plant. As a citizen of the community of Watertown, I am pleased that Missouri River has had the foresight to plan for our community's future needs by participating in the building of a cost-efficient plant like Big Stone. I've had the additional opportunity since I sit on Missouri River's Board of Directors to help the planning process and make some of the decisions that led up to this point. And as such, I encourage the PUC to approve the application here. We need the power in Watertown, and I thank you for allowing comments.
My name is Corey Ostern. I sit on the South Dakota Building Trades Committee, and I'm an electrician by trade. The Building Trades Committee, and which represents nearly 20 different crafts, have been working with the Black and Veatch and the owners group of Big Stone 2 for the past several months. I believe we are all well aware of the power needs facing our country as of today. We, the South Dakota Building Trades, feel Big Stone 2 will address the power needs for our region. There is a signed contract agreement between the South Dakota Building Trades and Black and Veatch for the Big Stone 2 project. We are very excited to have the opportunity to show the professionalism of our South Dakota workforce. The projected manpower for this project should exceed 1,200 craftsmen. And with our established apprenticeship programs, the building trade endorsed helmets to hard hats for our military personnel. In addition, we are creating links with the governor, with Governor Rounds' workforce development programs, the vocational schools, and tribal employment rights offices. We believe the Big Stone 2 project will benefit not only the consumers, but with the talk of other possible power plants in the state of South Dakota and surrounding states, we believe it would be a tremendous opportunity for more South Dakotans to become trained, skilled craftsmen. Thank you for this opportunity.
Good evening, Commissioners and Mr. Smith. My name is Mariah Hicks. I am currently the Executive Director for the Milbank Area Chamber of Commerce. Tonight, I would like to offer my testimony in favor of the Big Stone 2 project. In my capacity as a Chamber Director, I speak to the missions of the Chamber, one of which is to encourage and support community growth and to stand behind projects that add value to our community. The creation of the Big Stone 2 plant will undoubtedly add economic growth and value for the existing businesses and add opportunities for the creation of new ones in Milbank and the region. Over the course of the week, you have heard detailed testimony regarding the intricate details of this project. Tonight, I speak to the general benefits the community of Milbank expects to experience. Future identity. Communities all around the state currently struggle to survive and maintain their identity. The construction and operation of Big Stone 2 will enable added stability to our community and ensure that Milbank will not become a mere memory of a once strong community. The Big Stone 2 project will create jobs of which will add vitality to our community and entice new families to the area and increase retail sales overall to the local economy. Communities are often identified by key industries, employers, and events in the community's history. The construction and operation of the first plant, Big Stone 1, was an event that helped establish the current business climate in Milbank. The employment Big Stone 2 or Big Stone 1 continues to provide to the area identifies it as a major employer with roots to the community. The construction of Big Stone 2 will again become an identifying time in our community's history. It is my belief that many of the other businesses established in Milbank might not exist if Big Stone Power Plant and other businesses like it were not in the area. Communities depend on major employers, and it is for that reason that we welcome the expansion of our good neighbor. Community preparedness. The community is ready to embrace and is continuing to prepare for the growth projected with the Big Stone 2 plant. Examples include the opening of a satellite clinic in Big Stone City, the establishment of a TIFT housing district with more in the planning phases, and planned law enforcement training and assistance measures. Housing was addressed yesterday. I was listening live via internet during Mr. Madden's testimony, most of which focused on housing. Milbank has and continues to prepare for additional housing, both temporary and permanent, for the Big Stone 2 project. As mentioned, we have begun the development of a TIFT housing district in Milbank, and we will not stop there. Although the construction phase would be 3 to 5 years, Milbank welcomes the tax dollars and increased retail sales that would come from the temporary workers living in our community during such time. In order for Milbank, Big Stone City, and other immediate communities to gain the full benefit from the project, we want to do what we can to accommodate and welcome workers living, sleeping, eating, and recreating in our communities. We want to take full advantage of the energy that will take place during the Big Stone 2 project and are aware of the undoubtable slowdown the local economy will face following the completion of the Big Stone 2 plant. Regardless, we want to take full advantage of the growth during the construction phase, the construction and completion phases of the Big Stone 2 plant. Milbank will continue to be creative in providing affordable, comfortable housing for temporary and permanent employees of the Big Stone of the power plant. I believe that Milbank is a progressive community and will take action to protect our residents from unreasonable rent increases, but will also act in a way that will allow and welcome as many temporary workers as possible. Job development. The Struven Research Business Research Bureau provided an economic impact highlight of Big Stone 2 Power Plant Construction Report. In this study, it was concluded that 35 full-time equivalents and 29 part-time positions in the community, as well as a projected 2,550 full-time equivalent positions during the construction, would result if Big Stone 2 were built. Milbank fully welcomes these jobs and the ripple effects it will bring to our community. I don't think you will find a community in the state against such growth if it were in their community. Alternative energy sources. In previous testimony and arguments, alternative energy sources have been mentioned. I think it important to look outside the industry directly and see that the existing Big Stone plant has enabled the growth of ethanol, an alternative fuel source, namely Northern Lights ethanol. This is, as you are aware, a growing industry with huge potential in South Dakota and the Midwest. The success of Northern Lights ethanol is partially attributed to the existing Big Stone plant and is an example of how two industries can work together to benefit each other. Big Stone Lake atmosphere. Comments have been made regarding the environment condition of Big Stone Lake and the qualities and such quality following the completion of the Big Stone 2 project. I would like to mention that lake development is at an all-time high. Every day, it seems that someone new is purchasing lakefront property, developing the land, and building recreation and retirement homes. The existing plant, Big Stone 1, and the anticipation of Big Stone 2 doesn't appear to act as a deterrent for lake development. It is my opinion that lake property will continue to climb as lakefront property is highly coveted. I would not be here tonight if I did not believe that this project would be a benefit to the local and regional economy, add to the quality of life for the residents in Milbank and the surrounding area, and overall provide a benefit to the state. When considering the arguments and testimony made throughout the week, I ask that you consider the effort put forth by each of the partner companies making up Big Stone 2. These partners have worked hard to meet and exceed environmental standards, not only for Big Stone 2, but to upgrade the existing plant. This should show the commitment to the area and provide that Big Stone 1 has, and prove that Big Stone 1 has been a good neighbor for the community, holds strong environmental conscience, and is making every effort to stay at the forefront of the industry and to act as a model for future projects. The partners of Big Stone 2 have thought this process through in a way that protects the community and maintains the good neighbor feeling that Big Stone 1 has provided our region. I hope that those intervening on this project take into consideration the weight and impacts of community growth and sustainability factors the construction and operation of Big Stone 2 will provide to our area. I believe it was Mr. Welk in his opening statements that identified many of these steps taken by Big Stone 2 in terms of protecting and maintaining the community's resources, i.e. sound, law enforcement, safety, roads, training, public relations, etc. By granting this permit, you can be assured that the project will proceed in the same thoughtfulness shown so far. Thank you for your time and consideration this evening.
Thank you, Ms. Hicks.
Good afternoon. First, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present here. I did attend the hearing in Milbank, and I subsequently sent a letter because I wasn't able to stay for the entire meeting. But I decided to come and testify simply because I think I'm going to try and cover some areas that the other speakers may not. My name is George Smith. I am the Economic Development Director from Grant County, a position I've held for 10 years since I retired in 1994. Too many numbers to work with. Prior to that time, starting in 1967, I was a superintendent of schools in Milbank, and I was very deeply involved in the activities that took place both locally in our county and at the legislative session during the spring in each of those 5 years of construction with Big Stone 2. There were many issues that came up there that affected us, including railroads, education, taxes, all kinds of things. And as those issues came before the legislature, I spent a lot of time here testifying and working as a lobbyist to address some of those issues. Therefore, I feel that I have sort of unique perspective as we had a test run, I call it, with Big Stone 1, and I have an idea of what we have to look forward to with Big Stone 2 if it is permitted. With that background, I guess I could address a number of separate issues, including economic development and education and impact on communities. But what I have attempted to do is to capsulize what I want to say with a short series of 10 position statements or policy statements or personal statements that I think might be worthy of this hearing. First, let me say that I am a strong supporter of Big Stone 2, and that comes from experiencing both the issues created by the original construction of Big Stone 1 and also from the lasting benefits that those of us who live in that immediate area in the Northeast have enjoyed as a result of having that plant there. With that being said, as I said, I've tried to summarize in a quick fashion the things I want to say, and I've entitled this What We Can Expect If Big Stone 2 Is Permitted, Built, and Then Is Operated by Otter Tail Power Company. You know, they're the operating firm of our current plant and have been since such inception with the Montana-Dakota Utilities, Northwestern Public Service, and Otter Tail being co-owners of that particular plant. And I'll just run through these quickly in a matter of time. We can expect that the facility will ensure a continuing supply of electric power that will meet the future needs of hundreds of thousands of customers, as well as to provide potential for a series of what I call huge energy farms along the Coteau Hills. You know, Millbank is just on the east side of those hills, and I think there are easements being taken right now in that area for energy farms that will be probably sprouting up there before too long. We'll have a facility that will provide additional employment in the community, bringing skilled workers into the area, families to repopulate Grant County and the communities that are there, children for our schools, and other benefits that come from having a greater population in the area. Presently, I believe Big Stone is projecting an additional 40 employees with the plant. Just by way of information, you may have seen some of this in the paper. Millbank has been blessed in the last 2 years with new businesses. Currently, we have 8 businesses that either committed themselves or are in the process of moving to the community, and we are looking at, we feel, somewhere between 100 and 150 jobs over the next 3 or 4 years as a result of Big Stone, the expansion of Valley Queen Cheese, some of those other businesses. We even have a plant there, a business that came in there from California that's operating out of our community at the present time. If the plant is permitted, we can expect it'll be operated by a company that has a staff with a 31-year demonstrated positive performance record from the operation of the original plant, a company that has a history of placing customer support and satisfaction at the top of their priority list, a company that will maintain their continuing quest to equip both the current plant and Big Stone 2 with the latest generating technology, thus creating greater efficiencies. I believe I'm right in this, that the Big Stone 2 was built as a 400-megawatt plant, and now they are able to produce 450 megawatts just through upgrades and technological advances in the last 30 years or so since they've been there. It'll be operated by a company that will continue to demonstrate a concern for the environment by the addition of the most technologically advanced air, water, and land-protected devices as they become available. Operated by a company that has planned for the future since Big Stone 1 was placed online in 1975 for the day and time when the need for additional generation capability would be created by changing social and demographic conditions. We talked about a second plant back in as early as probably 1973, 1974. That was on the drawing board at that time, and of course, it took many, many years for it to come to this point, but nonetheless, it was planned at that point, or we knew there would be a greater need. It will be operated by a company that has demonstrated their intent to encourage additional new industry in the area, as has been evidenced by their cooperative development of the Northern Lights Ethanol Plant, which is adjacent to Big Stone 1. It's a company that has been very active in each of the communities that they serve by providing both funding and human support for special projects of educational activities and community functions. And last but not least, the additional financial resources that will come for the state of South Dakota and its eligible political subdivisions. In summary, I would urge your full support of Big Stone 2. It has been identified as a necessity to ensure the future growth and development of the region in which we live. Beyond that, due to the effort undertaken to create the consortium of partners supporting the project, and the projected cost, it is an opportunity that may be gone forever if we do not recognize it as what could be a one-time possibility. With that, I appreciate the opportunity to speak here, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Yes,
good evening. My name is David Bergen. I'm a retired high school principal. And you might wonder why a high school principal would be here to testify. I just want to reflect for a minute. When my first years as a principal, I was a pretty young fellow, and all of a sudden somebody mentioned the fact that there might be a power plant built in our school district. It might make a significant difference in the community. And, of course, I'm like everyone else. You have to kind of show me first. And I just want to relate to you what Big Stone 1 meant to our community, and I will relate later what I think Big Stone 2 will bring to our community. Anytime you have construction going on, you have people moving in. And we were always a good school, but we were kind of closeted in the country school mentality. We were kind of all in the same community, and we'd been there for a long time. No new ideas were generated, and we were just kind of status quo. Many times, in looking back, I kind of wonder why we didn't move faster in some of the things that we should have been doing. But the construction of the Big Stone Power Plant allowed us to bring new people into the community, give us new ideas, and get us off dead center. And we did. Not only did it allow us to put up a new building, which was very significant, but it allowed us to enhance our curriculum to the point where most of us, when we graduated from high school, if we had 16 credits, that was it. That was the benchmark. From the time, from 1975, when the power plant came online, until 20 years later, we were already at 20 credits. That was one of the things that caused to happen because we had an enhanced curriculum. Before we had a hammer and a board and we called it industrial arts. Then all of a sudden we have woodshop one, woodshop two, auto mechanics, and all the things that went along, plus the college level math, the college level English, all the things that we probably should have had earlier, but we didn't because we didn't have the staff, we didn't have the facilities, and that's what this plan allowed us to do. And the people that moved into the community were very instrumental in making us aware that, hey, you've got a good school, but you've got a ways to go. And needless to say, we moved down the right road. Fine arts and the various areas were enhanced considerably just through the facility and being able to hire people that had expertise in that area and moved us down the road in the right direction. Now, my comments are going to be short and brief, but you say, well, okay, that's well and good for Big Stone 1 causing that to happen in the Milbank School District. What's going to happen to Big Stone 2? Well, if you're looking around the state, you know, there are a lot of communities that would just love to be able to maintain their student population. That's one of the things that could be beneficial because it's difficult with the small families that we have nowadays. Even if you move 10 new families into the community, it doesn't add a lot of kids to the enrollment. And that's one of the things that I'm certain at least will give us a little more stability in our school system because when we started in 75, we had 530 kids in high school. And right now, this last in kindergarten enrollment was at below 60. So now that kind of tells you where our school is headed without growth. So that's one of the things that hopefully Big Stone Power Plant will allow us to do. There's a number of other things that can also be benefited in terms of new ideas and approaches that people bring into the community. But one of the last comments I want to make is when we had open house at our new school back in 77, 78 when we walked in there, we had a room that we thought we were miles ahead of the rest of the world. We really didn't know what we were doing, but we had a room that was built that was probably 8 by 10, and on top of the door, it said computer. And I can remember the people coming through the open house saying, what do you got that for? What's this computer thing? Well, that's one of the things that's coming, you know. Well, needless to say, that's a closet now. You know, it really is. It's a closet. And so my point is, you know, we couldn't see the future in 1977, 78, and look where we're at today. What does Big Stone Power Plant 2 mean to our community in terms of education and growth? I have no idea. I think it's exciting to think that we've got the potential at least to grow and look at the future in a bright way rather than just kind of gloomsday like a lot of communities have to look at it. So we're a community that's very happy with Ottertail, and they've been very, very good neighbors and very good contributors to the community. And with that, I'll end my comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe if there's coffee, I'd appreciate it.
Anyone else interested in writing some public comment? Oh, now we've got competition. Who can get here first? Come on up, ma'am. That's fine.
I thought maybe I should come at the end of the comment period. in case someone wanted to ask me questions. I have no objection to that, and I would even welcome it, but I'm not credentialed in the things that I'm talking about, so I may not be worth questioning. However,
well, ma'am, plenty of the people who believe they've been credentialed this week weren't really worth asking any questions of. So, if you have something you wanna offer, we would take your comments either as sworn, sure, as sworn testimony or as public comment. What would you prefer?
I only have footnotes of things that I have read and discussed with other people who are the credentialed people. You can swear me in if you want. I've got the footnotes I doubt it would be worth your while, but if you have questions, I do welcome them.
Well, let's do it that way. Let's go ahead and have you provide some comments, and then, you know, if we've all got right, some follow-up questions,
sure,
we may offer them.
Right.
It may not be grilled cross-examination, but we won't be bashful at asking you a follow-up if we have one.
Fine.
Great.
My name is Jean Koster, and I'm here for myself. This is a good process, and it's complementary to the federal process that is going on, the environmental impact statement process, the NEPA process. The two do complement each other, and it's worth noting that the NEPA process is being extended. You may be aware of that the deadline has gone forward. And that is really good because there are some very serious, serious shortcomings in the draft. Not that there are not also glories in that draft. The people who did the draft did an excellent, excellent job of laying out all of the implications of the transmission capability that is going to be installed, improved, the substations that may be improved or even reconstructed. Very good job there. But there are other aspects which are far from adequate, and it is one of those that I want to address tonight. A man in a suit knocks at your door and makes a proposal. He suggests that a small commitment on your part can materially advance the greater good. A flurry of temporary employment would inject much appreciated cash around the Milbank area. After that, there would be about 36 permanent new jobs. God bless those 36 lucky families and lucky Milbank to get them. Plus, new transmission capacity will be added and substations will be upgraded or even reconstructed so that people somewhere, mostly Minnesota, will have more electricity as they need to tap into it. And if they don't need it, their utilities can really improve their bottom lines by selling it to folks pretty far away, but probably still in MAP, mostly in Minnesota, or even further away in MAP, our regional power pool. All you have to do is volunteer your child, most likely as yet unborn, for a special game, the cost-benefit lottery. In this special lottery, the child wins if his number does not come up. If the child's number does come up, he gets to have neurological impairment. Maybe behavioral problems or learning problems, or maybe just ants in his pants. Maybe he'll really luck out and just have a few points shaved off his IQ. They'll never be missed. Kids are lovable no matter. Your child could suffer neurological impairment because his mother ate mercury-tainted fish. Fortunately, you can take comfort that he at least lives in South Dakota, where mercury is less toxic than it is in Minnesota. Believe it or not, once that mercury gets across the border into Minnesota, it immediately becomes one-third more dangerous. A Minnesota regulatory official told me, if I understood rightly, Their action level for a mercury advisory is 2 parts per million, whereas South Dakota allows 3 parts per million. Or the child could turn out bipolar if his mother did not eat the fish. It seems that omega-3 fish oils from fish are essential for healthy neurological development, and bipolarity can be a deficiency disease caused by lack in the mother's diet. For an undetermined proportion of individuals, vegetable source omega-3 oils will not suffice. Deepwater fish are the best source, but the fish in our lakes are a not insignificant source and what is available to people on tight budgets. Mom just has to eat more fish. Wait, I momentarily forgot. Mom's not supposed to eat the fish. Then again, the mercury problems can happen even if mom doesn't eat fish. The child could turn out mildly or even frankly autistic. He could, if the laws of physics and developmental physiology are the same here as in Texas, where a study of 1,200 school districts published in 2005 showed a very significant increase in autism in counties having coal-fired power plants. Texas is not the land of 10,000 lakes or even very many rivers, so not all those little people are autistic because their moms ate fish that their dads caught. The relationship between child neurological impairment and moms or kids under 15 eating fish is well understood. Not so well understood is harm done to exposure from other pathways. But that harm is there and evidently measurable. The increase was 17% for every 1,000 pounds of mercury released by those power plants. Not annually, but cumulatively. Even adhering closely to the requirements of the Clean Air Mercury Rule, Big Stone 1 and 2 will easily liberate more than that half ton in the first 5 or 6 years of combined operation. Who gets to be in the 17%? All right. If I interpret correctly, the Big Stone people say in their federal draft EIS that they intend to keep their mercury emissions at the allowable limit of a fictional 144 pounds a year. Fictional, because that limit is achieved by actually emitting 189.6 pounds yearly after a grace period allowing them to emit more while they work the bugs out of their emissions controls. But they get credit for 144 by purchasing mercury control credits from utilities in other states who reduce their mercury emissions more than the Clean Air Mercury Rule requires. They might even buy those credits next door in Minnesota, where the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is requiring that any utility with more than 500 megawatts of generation must eliminate mercury emissions by 90% by 2015, some sooner. The Minnesota power plants will be using technology the Big Stone people have told me in conversation is too expensive for them. Too likely to make the electricity discouragingly expensive. Yet, Minnesota MPCA people assure me that, even for Big Stone, the cost would be truly marginal. 2 to 3 million to install and troubleshoot, about 2 million annually to operate thereafter. The Big Stone people are opting to avoid paying that cost and instead to have some little kids pick up the tab for life because their number came up in the neurological lottery. The 144 pounds in itself is somewhat puzzling. The figure is South Dakota's total allowance under the Clean Air Rule. Our DENR has a new rule themselves, saying that one utility can't hog the state's whole allowance. And after 5 years, 2016 for Big Stone 1 and 2, the utility must even give back some of its original actual allowance, which would be not 144 pounds, but 129.6 pounds, I believe. Yet, in the draft EIS, they make clear they are indeed counting on hogging the whole 144 pounds. By 2018, the federal government will have cut South Dakota's mercury emissions allowance to 58 pounds. In their draft EIS, Big Stone people are showing no plan for making the jump from actual 189 pounds to whatever part of 58 pounds they are entitled to use. And it will be part of the 58 pounds. Surely the state will not allow them to hog the whole 58. Which brings me to request something from the Public Utilities Commission. I don't know if you can do this. I think you may feel strongly constrained by rules not to. But see if you can. Please put off your decision on permitting Big Stone 2 until there is a record of decision on the draft EIS. The project co-owners, as I say, did an excellent job in some respects on that draft. And we want the power here. But do we have to take it on those neurological lottery terms? The omissions and confusions for some other issues in the draft also practically ensure that for the total bucket, some material changes will be introduced before a record of decision is rendered. It would be ironic if you would approve the plant that is submitted to you along with a neurological lottery for our children. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Custer.
Zorich from Mount Vernon, South Dakota. It was too hot to bail this evening, so I heard you guys were up here, so I thank the commissioners for the opportunity to speak here this evening.
What was your name again, sir?
I'm Ron Zorich from Mount Vernon, South Dakota. And I would like to address, and I would like to commend the developers of the plant and thank the commissioners for doing their public job of making sure that the general welfare is provided for and taken care of. And when I look at the economic crisis the nation's in right now with the past six to eight, 10-month period of the inflation on commodities and energy cost in this country. And you can take copper, for instance. In the past year, it's went from $2,000 a ton to $9,000 a ton. And it's dropped back now, of course. But anyway, if you look at the value of copper in a penny, it wouldn't take long, and it would be a dollar. So we have a monetary system where a dollar is worth a penny. And those are the things that I think about. And right now, I think about the rest of our national economy and our local economy also, where we're looking at the auto sector, General Motors going into bankruptcy, most likely, Delphi already in bankruptcy. Many of our airlines are already in bankruptcy. And we have to come up with another source or a more efficient use of energy. And one of the things that I have been very excited about and promoting since I was in Germany in 1993 and rode on the maglev train at 300 mile an hour, where you have the potential to move 1,500 people at 300 mile an hour with less energy than it takes to drive my ton truck down the road. I think these are things that we need to look at. And it's essential that we have plants like Big Stone 1 and Big Stone 2 to provide that. They have to be environmentally clean, and I commend the people on the development up there, and to me it looks like it has been environmentally clean. I think right away with something like this, we could basically give ourselves a transportation system, and we could put General Motors and Delphi people back to work. That machine tool sector is essential to the security of the United States of America. But they have to have the energy sources to run these type of transportation systems with. And that's what Big Stone 2 is all about in the big picture, I think. It will vastly develop South Dakota and the nation, especially if we could, run a segment of this from, say, Mexico City of 25 million people to Fairbanks, Alaska, and parallel it along the Missouri River. Parallel along Highway 83, and then every 100 miles start the development of a new city. This is how Abraham Lincoln brought the economy out of a recession and did not use Economics 101, the nickel on the ticket, to pay for it. It was all the new development that paid for it in the process, and it was essential to the future. And that's what Big Stone 2 is. It's essential to the future. The young people need this. 50 years in the future, we need that. We cannot depend on sources of biofuel, such as ethanol. It takes, I believe, most of the studies, or many of the studies, refer to taking 2.5 gallons of diesel fuel to make a gallon of ethanol. How do you generate ethanol at $7.24 a gallon now and make statements like, we're going to raise the corn prices, when my local elevator this afternoon was $1.67. And ethanol is, corn has gone in 97 from $4.50 to $1.50 in the last, and we've been adding ethanol plants all the time. I really don't see any benefit to ethanol, especially if it's, you can't get more energy out of it than you put into it. Big Stone 2 is not that case. It's a very good, clean source of energy that we need for the future. Magnetism, and also I think the potential is even there for hydrogen to tie in with hydrogen production, which will be a fuel of the future. So, one other comment. I look at what the Chinese are doing right now, and they have become our biggest competitor. They have just finished Three Gorges Dam, and if I read it right, they're able to produce 17 times the electricity on one dam that we're producing on the whole series of Missouri River dams. They are moving very rapidly with nuclear energy, as I've seen in France and in Germany and Europe when I was over there, very cleanly, very efficient, a very cheap source of fuel. I think we have to look at that. One statement that I picked up on here and just wrote down from China's President Zeman's trip to the United States was, creativity is a source of national wealth, and it's an inexhaustible source. And I thank you guys for the creativity that you put into this project. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wazirik.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wazirik. Does anyone else wish to speak? Pat, I see you back there. Okay, thank you. Ms. Stevie, I think we've seen you before.
I know. Even. It's a good thing I'm a Gemini. Am I Mary Jo or am I Clean Water Action? I am Clean Water Action tonight. Mary Jo representing Clean Water Action. And I speak tonight on behalf of South Dakota Clean Water Action. Our office is located at 231 South Phillips Avenue, Suite 250, Sioux Falls. Last September 13th, 2005, there was a public hearing before the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission in Milbank on the proposed Big Stone 2 project. A request was made by quote-unquote Stevie at that time to have the draft environmental impact statement address total maximum daily load, better known as TMDL, for the mercury levels in Big Stone Lake and in waters within a 50-mile radius. The transcript from the Milbank hearing reads, with Chairman Hansen speaking, quote, Nancy from WAPA, would you please make an attempt, if you can, if you cannot, just tell me, will the environmental impact statement that WAPA is entering address those, brackets, mercury TMDL questions by Stevie, issues? Nancy Wordell speaking, quote, it will have water quality impacts as part of that study. And I took a couple of notes, comma, and we'll take those back and put those as part of our scoping as an inclusionary thing into the EIS. The above TMDL request was specifically made by Stevie because in the application for Big Stone 2, the applicants did not calculate, analyze, or study mercury impacts on humans or the environment. The applicants did not measure mercury levels or risk, and neither does the recently released draft EIS address current mercury levels or measurements in the water or fish. In other words, we do not have any information from the proposed Big Stone 2 project on mercury load currently in the water or in the fish that not only could but would be increased by continued and or increasing mercury emissions from the proposed Big Stone 2. Because of how mercury bioaccumulates in the environment, operation of both plants, even if at the same mercury emissions from 2004 of 189 pounds, decidedly increases mercury accumulation and degradation in the environment. What will this mean for future real estate development along the lake? What will this mean for future revenues from tourism and the fishing industry? Who will want to come and reside, fish, or swim in a toxic, laden lake? Will we have not only increased health risk, but also a socioeconomic bust? According to South Dakota Codified Law 49-41B-22, it is the applicant's burden of proof to establish that, two, the facility will not pose a threat of serious injury to the environment nor to the social and economic condition of inhabitants or expected inhabitants in the siting area, and that, three, the facility will not substantially impair the health, safety, or welfare of the inhabitants, and four, the facility will not unduly interfere with the orderly development of the region. Clean Water Action members are deeply concerned about the inconsistency and the lack of analysis on mercury and other toxic emissions. The application for the proposed Big Stone 2 does not address in a calculated, cumulative manner what the impact would be on human, plant, and environment surrounding the area. Neither does the draft EIS. In fact, the draft EIS shows and records an expected release of 399 pounds of mercury into the environment once Big Stone 2 comes online, as does evidence submitted via discovery, which can be found in Stevie Exhibit 1G. Even though applicants have recently submitted a letter giving voluntary commitment to emit no more than 189 pounds of mercury, South Dakota budget for future mercury emission under the Clean Air Mercury Rule
falls to 144-pound requirement in 2010, then down to 58 pounds by 2018. What about health risk cost? Our members are concerned. Why should local populations bear the brunt of toxic risk? Mercury control technologies are available now, and the need for such very clear. Model rules have been crafted, providing states with guidance. For example, regulating mercury from power plants, a model rule for states and localities. November 2005, State and Territorial Air Pollution Program Administrators, Association of Local Air Pollution Control Officials. We can do better for our children, our health, our water, our future. In order for a decision to be made, everything should be on the table, and people should know what are we risking and what is the trade-off. Clean Water Action South Dakota recommends further evaluation and calculation of the mercury risk before a permit is issued for the proposed Big Stone 2. Clean Water Action contends that applicants have failed to provide proof that Big Stone 2, as proposed, will not pose a threat of serious injury to the environment, nor to the social and economic condition of inhabitants or expected inhabitants in the siting area, nor have applicants provided proof that the facility will not substantially impair the health, safety, or welfare of the inhabitants or unduly interfere with the orderly development of the region. Clean Water Action South Dakota sincerely thanks the Public Utilities Commissioners for the opportunity to comment in this matter.
Thank you, Ms. Stevie. Good evening, Pat.
Good evening, John, and members of the commission. I thank you for having the opportunity to speak to you too, to address some concerns that I want to voice on behalf of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy. I represent tribes not only in South Dakota, but in the surrounding states as well, in North Dakota, Nebraska, Wyoming, and with affiliates in other regions, including Minnesota tribes and other organizations there. We look at issues in utility policy on tribal lands, so from regulatory, educational, as well as environmental and economic perspectives. We are also have a real large emphasis on wind energy development and are managing the development of an 80-megawatt intertribal wind project, on 8 reservations with several others poised to come on and join in this effort. We're looking at community wind power as well as municipal wind power markets and also the federal government as a potential purchaser of wind energy for federal facilities and needs for other federal agencies, as well as other cities that are in our region and outside our region that are aware of the tremendous wind energy potential that we have here in South Dakota. Just as an example, I know many of you as members of the commission are aware of this, but I want to point this out for the record here because I do want our comments to be entered into the record. And I would like to submit the draft, a written document tomorrow, your deadline. So I thank you for that opportunity. I'll just summarize them here tonight. But we sit, in the middle of a vast resource of wind in this country. And According to estimates by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, we have over 276,000 megawatts of wind energy on tribal lands alone. And we also have the benefits of being all on the Western Area Power Administration's transmission system, much of which originates and transverses tribal lands. And we have given up much for the development of that system in the way of sacrificing lands for the Missouri River Reservoir System for flood control primarily, with power production kind of as a byproduct, really. If all the dams are full and running at max capacity, that capacity is about 2,500 megawatts of energy annually. Well, we can do that on tribal lands easily. So can many farmers and ranchers and communities in South Dakota. We enjoy the most consistent wind, I think, of any state in the Northern Plains, and have more transmission access points here. So, but it's not only wind energy that we are concerned about. As tribal people, we are very conscious of impacts on our land and our water, the ecosystems, the plant nations, the animal nations, and the fish nations, and as well as the unborn generations. We think down the road quite a bit, something we share with other tribes in that we think ahead seven generations of impacts today. And that's something we've learned from our grandfathers. We may have strayed a bit in some decisions we make today to meet the need for revenue, jobs, employment that everybody needs out here in rural America and the Northern Plains in particular that we're all very aware of. Some of those economic impacts here that we are still recovering from, is the flooding of the Missouri River. Our economies have never been returned quite to the state that they were at that time. We got along pretty good. I always quote one of our elders who has passed on now to the spirit world, but he is a Standing Rock Lakota. His name is Vine Deloria. You know, many of you have read of him. He's a well-known scholar, but he equated the flooding of the Missouri River and the impacts on all of the tribal nations is probably the second most significant impact to the economies, cultures, and ecosystems of the tribal nations since the killing of the buffalo. And I believe that. I know the impacts of that flooding, what it's had on us, our communities, and we've been trying to rebuild and live an increasing population not enough land to go around to sustain everybody, and having all of those problems that are resulting from that, and our best land's gone. So we take a look at some environmental justice. This 80 megawatt wind project has been recognized by an interagency task force, a national competition comparison, if you will, with brownfields, other things that are polluted, other actions that have resulted in harms to the environment and human health and such. And it's been accepted. They've never looked at an issue like that before, but the way we presented it, it was accepted. So I don't mean to dwell on that right now, but I want to use that as a background for some economic justice we feel we have coming. And one of those, one way that's possible is the development of wind energy resources. And we know the wind doesn't blow all the time, but it blows about half the time here. And we are looking to partner with the utilities that are here, our rural electric co-ops, of which we are members. We're members of communities served by municipal power companies, and we're served by investor-owned utilities on reservations, too. And those over by Big Stone, are Sisseton and Flandreau, who are members of Intertribal Coup. And virtually all of the river tribes, as well as the Oglalas, there in Rosebud, Yankton, the Omahas, and Nebraska, we're all aware of power needs and the management issues on the Missouri River, and we think wind energy can impact all of those. So we're looking for creative ways to partner to provide power not only for our communities, but for this region to meet new load growth, new demand, and serve new markets. But we want to do so carefully. These three issues, you know, we have here are a concern for our environment, global warming, and the economic impact of wind energy for this whole region. And I share the comments made by some of the other people here and those that I've read from other proceedings and, you know, that I've read online and in the papers, in that I hope you take a very good look at the environmental impacts and analyze it, and not rush into any decisions there without knowing full well the complete mercury output as well as the sulfur dioxide and the nitrous oxide, acid rain and smog. You know, people in South Dakota think, you know, we've got a pretty pristine environment. We don't see a lot of that smog. But you can see it if you're in North Dakota before the wind comes up. You wake up in Bismarck and look to the east. It's there. I don't wake up in Milbank very often, but I don't think I ever have. I've driven through there pretty early, but I think you might be able to see some there. But around where there's other coal plants, you can see it. There's particulate matter there. We've got a lot to do to clean up existing emissions here, and the technology is being researched to do that. I have high hopes that coal gasification is going to be one of the answers to controlling emissions and pollutants, as well as CO2 and sequestering that back into the earth or other ways. I really hope that there can be a partnership with the coal industry and wind energy, because we need to do that to provide our own needs as well as meet some of those large needs in other areas. And you all are very well aware that we need increased transmission to access those market areas. And with this new plant here, I would hope that that is a major consideration also, that you would partner with those entities that want to develop wind energy and move it to urban areas to the east of us. But we know the wind blows in every direction here. You know, some places it's longest and strongest from the northwest, but we find out in our Met Tower studies, at least, you know, down here in the middle of South Dakota, down in Rosebud and some other places, that it's coming from the south. Now, I don't know if that's changed in the last 10 years or not, but it's surprising that your most consistent wind's coming from there in some places. I don't know what it's how the wind blows over there, but there's Met Towers around in that area, I know, and you might do well to check on that, and just to, so you can take a look at a wind rose or a graph that shows where the most consistent wind comes from for most of the year. So my concern, again, here is it has to do with global warming, and that's been a debatable issue for years, but I'll tell you now, 5 years ago, even, a lot of folks didn't think it's really an issue, but we keep breaking records for the hottest July on record. Ice flows are breaking off of Antarctica the size of Connecticut and Rhode Island. They say you're going to be able to take a boat ride across the North Pole in a few years. I got to throw my lot in with 5,000 scientists around the world that says this is happening. You can argue about the cause of it all you want, but it is happening. And one of the causes we feel is emissions from both our transportation and from burning fossil fuels for energy, and primarily coal. So we've got to do something about it. We've got to control that, the pollutants that come from it, and also CO2. You know, that hasn't been treated as a pollutant before, but there's a case before the Supreme Court now with about 10, 12 states, I believe now, that are saying that it is a pollutant, and Uncle Sam, you better treat it as one, because it is it's causing some serious impacts in urban areas and in human health, and that's the biggest one here, human health and infrastructure. And if a lot of folks don't believe it's happening in an industry, it's pro and con. There are groups that are planning for the future and what to do about it. Probably the biggest industry or business that is looking at global warming and its impacts is the insurance industry. they've got the best data on what's happening with climate change of anybody, because that's their business. Keep breaking records for payouts from natural disasters. Also, and there are some places they will not insure anymore. Things are happening. Things are changing. We have standards for pollution control that are set for, you know, the mercury, SOx, NOx, and such. They're different in each state, has been pointed out. You know, how does that change across a boundary line, you know, that is on paper, but you don't notice it much when you're driving, walking, or riding a horse over there. And we know that very well from having our treaty lands from Canada down into Kansas to the Bighorn Mountains and over to Wisconsin, where the sun literally used to rise and set on the lands of the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota Nation. So climate doesn't know any boundaries either, and neither do things that happen from climate change, such as different types of disease, bugs, insects that are coming north, malaria, dengue fever, West Nile disease. Unheard of when we were growing up, right? And things are happening. So we got to do something about it. We got to be aware of it and use the technologies that's there. Be creative, as I heard mentioned here. There's no other time but now where we need to do that and partner together, because we're not going anywhere unless South Dakota, federal government, or others would like to give us back some of our land. We might expand a bit, but we're here. We're here for the long haul. And we have a median age of 18 compared to 30 and going up in the rest of this country. So we've got a big, big responsibility to provide for our youth and to protect what little bit of land we have left and find ways to sustain ourselves. So we're looking at survival for the future. We're looking at the jobs that are in renewable energy. And we come to this climate change realization not only from our beliefs and our prophecies and our ceremonies, where these messages are still coming through, but from a group of scientists that worked at the U.S. Global Change Research Program and did the National Assessment on Impact of Climate Change. Bob Goff, who represents the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, is the Secretary of Intertribal Kuenai. We co-chaired the Native People's Native Homelands Workshop in that assessment and helped write some of those impacts. We helped compile and gather it from this whole country, because it was literally Indian country at one time, and still is or isn't, depending on your perspective. But it's where we live, where we have cultural history of place and such. So we put spiritual leaders and tribal environmentalists together with scientists. And the scientists' comments were that we knew that you people had traditional knowledge, but what we heard here, we are literally blown away. So we knew this was coming. Our grandfathers and grandmothers told us, and they still do. So we got to do something about it. And one of the solutions is renewable energy. And we're not alone in that area. I know the commission shares some of the potential and the hope that we can develop the wind resources that we have here for the tremendous economic development that it can create. And, you know, the support industries that are there. The same kinds of jobs in building trades, electricians, that you need with coal plants, you need with wind. And I look to partnerships that way. So I just want you to take a real hard look at the resources that we have left that are becoming scarce. And water is not the least of which. It takes a lot of water to produce steam. You know, to turn a turbine, it takes a lot of water to cool a coal plant. Also, look at those resources and be able to estimate that into the future, taking a look at that. And maybe you get a little more rain over there in the east now, because precipitation patterns have changed from West River to East River big time. And so I just want to say that we are not alone in our concern for the environment. Maybe people don't voice it as often as they'd like to, but you know, we share with farmers, ranchers, and other communities in the state of South Dakota that surrounds all of our tribal lands here, that we care about our children, we care about our earth and the ecosystem that we live in, and we want to protect it. We also want to have jobs, and we want to have a standard of living that's fair, that's equal to what it takes to provide for a family these days. And we have people, unemployment of 50 to 80% there that nobody else does. So nobody's hungrier for new jobs, new projects than tribal people. Tell me, if there are, I don't know where, but we're not in so much of a hurry that we will make decisions without all the facts and not weighing all the impacts. So that's my comments to you, to consider looking at everything from a larger holistic perspective, because we know that everything is related. We're all connected here in this area, the rest of this Western Hemisphere, around the world. And we have a saying that's kind of like our amen when we pray. It's called Mitakuye Oyase. All my relatives, or we are all related, and that means everything from us here to our relatives and our families, to all the plant nations, animal nations, all of creation across the earth and out to the stars. So think about it like that once when you go home, or go out on a hill, take a good hard look and look deep. And we have time to weigh these decisions. So let's get the facts and partner together to make a sustainable future for our children. Pila me apelo. I thank you for this time.
Thank you, Pat.
Any questions? I'll share state.
Questions? I was just going to, you didn't introduce yourself to the audience, Pat. This is Pat Spears, who's been my friend for 35 years. So, do the commissioners have any questions?
I would just like the record to note that John Smith does have a friend, apparently.
So, I've got two now.
He's not admitting it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Good evening. I'm pleased to be able to have the opportunity to address the Public Utility Commission here in South Dakota. My name is Bob Goff, G-O-U-G-H. I'm an attorney, and my training is also in cultural ecology. I did my graduate work towards the PhD in cultural ecology and anthropology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and my law degree at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. For the last 20 years, I've had the privilege and honor of living and working on the Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation. I was the initial director of the Tribal Utility Commission, established in 1994, and have served, stepped down from that director position and have served as a consultant for them through the years since. I serve also as the Secretary of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy, one of the Rosebud delegates, and have worked with the Intertribal Council on the work that Pat Spears has referred to with regard to tribes across North and South Dakota, Nebraska, now Minnesota, and Wyoming, looking at energy development, wind development, and the like. I've also had recently the privilege of serving on the Western Governors Association's Clean and Diversified Energy Advisory Committee. And in that capacity, I sat on the committee itself and on the wind and transmission task forces, and sat in periodically on some of the other, they call them stovepipe task forces, the different technologies. The Western Governors Clean Diversified Energy Advisory Committee looked at wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, energy efficiency, and what was initially called clean coal, and then was changed to advanced coal technologies, to be able to look at how the Western states, and in this case that included North and South Dakota, although we're on the other side of the grid for the most part of the Western grid, how we could include and realize the goals set by the Western governors of 30,000 megawatts of clean energy, new energy in the West, developed between now and 2015, over the next 10 years. This is the planning horizon that one would expect likely for any new major new power plants, and it seemed like a long way away when we started the discussions 2 years ago, and now we're in the better part of 8.5 years from that goal. They also looked at energy efficiency goals of reaching 20% of energy efficiency, greater efficiency in the West by the year 2020. So there's some pretty admirable and what we believe was achievable goals for the West to be able to develop new energy projects throughout the West that would have less impact on the pollution, less impact on the air and water resources, and with a focus on the reduction of carbon dioxide emissions. I went through the degrees and the universities of where I got them to sort of explain to you that I've been moving upwind from Wisconsin to Minnesota to South Dakota, and the air has gotten increasingly better with each move, I'll tell you that. And there is something to be appreciated about that wind shed, something to be appreciated about the resources here. And while I see that the governor in Minnesota and this has just signed recently a law with regard to mercury, that law does not quite extend across the border into South Dakota, although any emissions produced here will end up there. We've looked at it in terms of the wind industry. We've watched a lot of dollars just flying east in the prevailing westerly winds into Minnesota and seeing that economy realized there. We're very much interested in seeing that economy realized here in South Dakota. But the issue of where the emissions go with regard to carbon dioxide isn't important. It's critical in terms of things like mercury, NOx and SOx, but for CO2 it's not important. It's the total accumulation of CO2 in the atmosphere that is what most of the world scientists who seriously study climate have indicated is what is responsible for global warming. Carbon dioxide, methane, and other gases. Water vapor is probably the most prolific gas, but that only stays in the atmosphere for about a week. Carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for about a century. What we put in today will be there 100 years from now. Mobridge will celebrate its bicentennial with the carbon we put in there today. I was just up there for the beginning of their celebrations this week. What I bring that up because I've had to spend some time at the Western, working with the Western governors in Denver, working with the National Renewable Energy Lab, also located in Denver and in Boulder, and I've spent some time in the Rockies. And what I've noticed in the last couple of years, being there on and off, is that that's where our Missouri River comes from. Not Colorado, but up in Wyoming and Montana. And this Missouri River that we're seeing now has the lowest record levels of water since we've been keeping records. If there were no dams on the river and we just counted on the flowage, the natural flowage, I think that the Lewis and Clark celebrations could have terminated in Bismarck. That would have been about as far as they could get, going horseback. We're looking at situations now in the Rockies with the snowpack where we not only get we fail to often get enough snowpack to meet the averages that we've seen in the past. And in Colorado this past year, they had above average snowpack and everyone seemed delighted that the drought was over. And that was in January and February and March. April and May were usually the wettest months of the year in that region of the Rockies. This year they were two of the driest that they've ever had on record. What they've had were warm winds, very warm winds and very dry winds. And what's happening with the snow in the Rockies this year is that it fails to melt. Even though they had above average snowfall, snowpack, it failed to melt. There's a process called sublimation, and the snow just turned to water vapor. It was that warm and dry, the air just sucked it up as water vapor, and it didn't make it into the streams. And this is what we're seeing in the headwaters of the Missouri River. We're seeing a very major change in where the water comes from. We're seeing a lot more of that water falling to the eastern part of South Dakota and into Minnesota, and we'll see floodings and the like. We've seen those kinds of weather extremes coming into play. We've seen that with losing Grand Forks a few years back. But what the issue is for this kind of shift, this kind of change, is that we're seeing more and more of the water that does come this way falling further and further east, and not behind the dams. It's falling below the dams, east or too far east to be able to fill in back behind the dams. So as we look to relying on hydropower, we're going to find that we may be short-circuiting that natural cycle of snowpack in the Rockies, precipitation throughout Montana, Wyoming, western Dakotas, and water behind the dams. And if you look at what the climate scientists up in Grand Forks, North Dakota, for example, at the Aerospace Program, who've been looking at the impacts of global warming throughout the West, they have said that the kinds of years that we've seen, the warmer, drier years, are what we are likely to expect under global warming scenarios. Many of the models that were put in place to look at global warming were extremely, extremely conservative. They wanted to be able to withstand any kind of scientific scrutiny. And what that meant was they've put rather conservative assumptions into place. And what we're seeing today are some of the forecasts that were 20, 30, 40 years down the road. We're starting to see those things happen already because those assumptions were perhaps a bit too conservative. I say that because you are faced with the decision of permitting something that is going to have an impact for the next 50, 60 years. Something that may be considered state-of-the-art when a permit process was begun several years ago may be based on some assumptions that no longer quite hold, policy assumptions that no longer quite hold, and state-of-the-art technology assumptions that no longer quite hold. We're on the verge of looking at a whole new set of technologies coming down, particularly for the coal industry, a vast resource that we have in the West, not necessarily in South Dakota. We're going to have to import coal. We're going to have to bring it in from someone else, someplace else. Probably going to have to bring it in by rail. Probably going to be running pretty near where I have to live and drive back and forth, going up and down in the north and south in the state, and looking at just on the DM&E proposal, 40 trains a day, 100 cars long, and that's not counting the empties coming back. We're looking at the energy that that resource can serve. It can come from coal. It can come from a variety of other resources. It can come from an abundance of the wind resource we have scattered across the entire state. And we could see income coming not just to one or two communities or one or two enterprises, but we could see income coming to ranchers, farmers, and reservations all over the state. We can see a new economy being built in this state based on renewables, supplement it with hydro, supplement it with coal. But we're going to need to be able to envision how do we want to be in 50 years? Do we want to have water at all in the West River? Now, I know people here were talking about the problems with wind and how unsightly they are. And I'm sitting here looking over your shoulders at a poster that has South Dakota changing and changeless with a wind turbine. Now, that's cute. It's an antique. Although we've got 62 of them working between my home and Mission and the Nebraska line pumping water. So they're functional. And they don't look so bad once you get used to them. A lot of local landowners have decided that the beauty of those goes up with your ownership interest. Not a bad thing. Well, I put that out on the table for you to consider, that the impacts of your decision will have impacts on this state and this country and this globe for the next 50 years and then some. There's going to be costs associated with this decision. Whatever gets approved through this permit process and gets built is going to be facing a change in regulatory schemes as they come down over the next 50 years, certainly in the next 20 years and probably within the next 10. This is what the Western governors were anticipating in looking at how do we begin to shift, how do we begin to build in another direction, not just the business as usual direction. Coal can provide a vast storehouse of energy and can provide a lot of other resources. We know the same thing with oil. But when we look at coal, we see that the state of the art today is not IGCC. It's not requiring sequestration of the carbon dioxide that comes out of those plants. That's not where the state of the art is, but that's where it's going to be in a very short time. And that is where the recommendations of the Western governors want to see it go. The Western governors have issued a report, and within that report called Clean Energy, A Strong Economy and a Healthy Environment. And in that, there's a series of appendices dealing with each of the fuel types. And the advanced coal appendix, it happens to be the first, and I'll just read a portion of it to you into this record. The Advanced Coal Task Force reached a carefully crafted agreement with regard to its support for advanced coal agreement, and the state-level incentives targeted only to Tier 1 and Tier 2 technologies that were agreed to are listed below. In addition to the state-level incentives, CDEC agrees to support federal incentives. But here's get to the point of what the governors are looking forward to. Advanced Coal Task Force Agreement on Advanced Coal Technologies. A. Support for continuing efforts to improve the efficiency and environmental performance of all advanced coal technologies examined by the task force. The task force technical work group examined the costs, performance, and environmental characteristics of a variety of commercially available and emerging advanced coal-fired electric generation technologies, including supercritical and ultra-supercritical pulverized and circulating fluidized bed combustion technologies, integrated gasification, combined cycle technologies. The technology workgroup report found that the advanced technologies examined typically demonstrated higher performance levels and lower emissions of critical pollutants, toxic pollutants, and carbon dioxide emissions than the new subcritical designs, as well as the current fleet of pulverized coal plants now in operation. The task force supports continuing efforts to improve the operational and environmental performance of all the advanced coal technologies listed in the technology report beyond current performance levels, with the ultimate goal of achieving near zero emissions at a competitive cost of electricity. And the second short paragraph is B, support the incentives for the development of advanced coal technologies that are not yet commercially viable and operate with superior environmental performance. I have a copy of the entire report on disk, which I would like to submit for the record to the commission. As we were welcomed in the opening statements, you are looking to see what kinds of policy concerns might be important in your deliberation on this permit. I would ask that you look to what the Western governors have come up with in terms of the best thinking they've got for at least the next 10 years. Look carefully at the opportunity that you have in being extremely deliberate. I don't know that South Dakota, and in fact, our governor is the new chairman of the current chairman this year of the Western Governors Association. Do we want to be the first state to permit the last of the old school technology? Can we find ways to make sure in this permitting process that whatever is built at Big Stone for Big Stone 2 reduces the emissions, doesn't just extend the emissions, current emissions out of Big Stone 1, has certain emissions capturing ready capacities built into it, we may be looking at some very inexpensive or competitive power coming out of it under today's regulatory scheme. But you lay a carbon tax, you lay liability for CO2, you lay a number of these other kinds of requirements coming down either regionally or federally on top of that, and are we selling the people in South Dakota and energy going into Minnesota something whose prices are going to be guaranteed to increase because of our failure at this point to take the proper precautions, to see what's coming ahead? I heard that one teacher for school official say, we don't know what's going to come. We didn't know in 77 what it was going to look like today. And he's absolutely right. The best guess we have is that from today over the next 10 years, there's going to be some major changes coming in technology and likely regulation liability. And all of that is just a portion of what's coming. We're looking at some – if the weather trends continue as we're seeing them, we're looking at some very serious issues for West River, for the rest of the state. And permitting something on the eastern side of the state may seem to have little relevance to what happens in the west, but to the extent that that is causing less water coming into our system, that is something that we are very, very concerned about. I will close with just a note that at the EERC up in North Dakota, they did some studies on global warming. They did it on climate change, I should say that. Not on global warming. They did it on climate change. And they were not looking ahead as most of the IPCC studies have been going ahead, what's coming down in the next 20, 30, 50, 100 years. They looked to the past. They looked at lake sediments across North and South Dakota, and they looked at sediment levels of the last 2,000 years to see what the natural variations have been, because you really don't know what we may be in store for. Maybe they are within the realms and in the range of natural variations. But they looked in the past, and what they found that this region here has experienced just in the last 2,000 years, wet and dry cycles. Wet cycles with little drought periods, dry periods, and dry periods with little wet spots here and there. And these cycles could last a century, century and a half for the last 2,000 years. And I would postulate that we've been looking at the last 7 to 9 years, certainly in the western part of the state, as seeing a drought situation, a persistent chronic drought situation. And maybe we are just in one of those short little dry periods during a longer wet cycle. But we've already had about a century and a half of a wet cycle. And we may be in the very early stages of the next dry cycle, just under natural variation, holding climate change aside. And just consider everything that's been built in the last 150 years in South Dakota. Almost everything that isn't Indian, that's the period of time when things were built. We've assumed a relatively wet period of time to be the natural way things are and always will be. These studies coming out of North Dakota suggest that's not at all the case. So I leave that to you to think about the past and to think about the future and to think about finding ways to do the best technology, bring the best technology we can to our resources. If coal is what we need to burn, let's make sure we burn it in a near zero emission fashion. Make sure that it doesn't waste or consume our water resources, that we're not polluting beyond our boundaries, and that we're providing as a guidance to both the operators and the communities who are going to depend on this, that we are looking forward in a way that's going to try to account for some of the things that the best scientists we have are telling us are coming down the road. So I don't think there's a I think if there's an opportunity for this commission to wait at least for the environmental impact statement to be finalized and to see how that information fits into your proposals and into your permitting procedure. I think that's at least what we can do. And making sure that there's provisions and conditions in the permits that make any new plant ready to meet the specifications and the regulations that are likely down the road. So with that, I thank you very much for your time, and I will leave this here with the recorder.
Thank you. Are there other persons who wish to comment?
Hello, my name's Steve Nelson, and I'm a farmer from Letcher, South Dakota. And I am in support of creating energy because we need to create it. We just can't not have energy because that's the way of the future. I'd like to talk about popular opinion first. And remember our opinion on DDT. It was mentioned here about malaria cases dying. The popular opinion of DDT was it's harmful. It kills people. Now, the World Health Organization just okayed it to spray DDT in houses. So what has popular opinion done? It's gone the opposite. So what controls popular opinion? Certainly the facts don't, because the facts were there that said DDT did not work. So that brings me to the point of nuclear energy. Nuclear energy, popular opinion was that it is unsafe. There's lots of waste. In fact, there is no waste. And I'd like to submit to every you, get a copy of this, and I'll leave one here, and we've got a couple extras. But an article in the 21st century I'd like to read right now, it's very short, about nuclear energy. It's not waste. Nuclear fuel is renewable. The first thing to know about nuclear waste is that it isn't waste at all, but a renewable resource that can be reprocessed into new nuclear fuel and valuable isotopes. The chief reason it is called waste is that the anti-technology lobby doesn't want the public to know about its renewability. Turning spent fuel into a threatening and insoluble problem, the anti-nuclear faction figured, would make the spread of nuclear energy impossible. And without nuclear energy, the world would not industrialize, and the world population would not grow. Just what the Malthusians want. The truth is that when we entered the nuclear age, the great promise of nuclear energy was its renewability, making it an inexpensive and efficient way to produce electricity. It was assumed that the nations making use of nuclear energy would reprocess their spent fuel, completing the nuclear fuel cycle by renewing the original enriched uranium fuel for reuse after it was burned in a reactor. When other modern fuel sources, wood, coal as this hearing is about, oil, gas are burned, there is nothing left except some ashes and airborne pollutant byproducts, which nuclear energy does not produce. But spent nuclear fuel still has from 95% to 99% of its unused uranium in it. So it's still, after we call it waste, there's still 95% of the energy in that uranium that we can reprocess. So that's what they're talking about, renewable resources in nuclear energy. This means that if the United States buries its 70,000 metric tons of spent nuclear fuel, we would be wasting 66 million metric tons of uranium-238, which would be used, which could be used to make new fuel. In addition, we would be wasting about 1,200 metric tons of fissile uranium-235 and plutonium-239. Because of the high energy density in the nucleus, this relatively small amount of fuel, it would fit in one small house, is equivalent in energy to about 20% of the U.S. oil reserves. 96% of the spent fuel can be turned into new fuel. The 4% of the so-called waste that remains, the 2,500 metric tons, consists of highly radioactive materials. But these are also usable. There are about 80 tons each of cesium-137 and strontium-90 that could be separated out for use in medical applications, such as sterilization of medical supplies, using isotope separation techniques, and fast neutron bombardment for transmutation technologies that the United States pioneered but now refuses to develop. We could separate out all sorts of isotopes like americium, which is used in smoke detectors, or isotopes used in medical testing and treatment. Right now, the United States must import 90% of its medical isotopes, used in 40,000 medical procedures daily. These nuclear isotopes could be mined from the so-called waste that we have in the United States now. Instead, the United States supplies other countries with highly enriched uranium so that those countries can process it and sell the medical isotopes back to us. In other words, there are other countries in China and Europe that are reprocessing this nuclear waste. But the United States did not want to go forward in doing that because they knew it would be a cheap source of energy. How fuel becomes spent? The fuel in the nuclear reactor stays there for several years until the concentration of the fissile uranium-235 in the fuel is less than about 1% at each point. I won't quiz you on these numbers, but I just wanted to get an extra a sense of how it's used, spent. A 1,000 megawatt nuclear plant replaces about a third of its fuel assemblies every 18 months. Initially, the fuel spent is very hot and is stored in pools of water which cool it and provide radiation shielding. After 1 year in the water, the total reactivity level is about 12% of what it was when it first came out of the reactor. And after 5 years, it is down to just 5%. Unlike other poisons, radioactive isotopes become harmless with time. This decay process is measured in terms of half-life, which refers to the amount of time it takes for the half of the mass to decay. Although a few radioisotopes have half-lives in the order of thousands of years, most of the hazardous components of nuclear waste decay to a radioactive toxicity level lower than that of natural uranium ore within a few hundred years. The spent fuel includes uranium and plutonium, plus all the fission products that have built up in its operation, and very small amounts of transuranic elements, those heavier than uranium, or antimonies, which have very long decay times. If this spent fuel is not reprocessed, it takes hundreds of thousands of years for its toxicity to fall below that of natural uranium. What are we really wasting? The spent fuel produced by a single 1,000 megawatt nuclear plant over its 40-year lifetime is equal to the energy in 130 million barrels of oil, or 37 million tons of coal, plus strategic metals and other valuable isotopes that could be retrieved from the high-level waste. Why don't we reprocess? the United States, which pioneered reprocessing, put reprocessing on hold during the Ford administration and shut down the capability during the Carter administration. Because of fears of proliferation, this left reprocessing to Canada, France, Great Britain, and Russia, plus the countries they service, including Japan, which is now developing its own reprocessing capabilities. In addition, new methods of isotope separation using lasers, such as the AVLIS program at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, were shut down or starved to death by budget cuts. As a result, today we have 40,000 plus metric tons of spent fuel safely stored at U.S. nuclear plants, which the anti-nuclear fearmongers rail about, even though they are the ones who created the problem because we weren't able to reprocess these. The plan to permanently store the spent fuel at the Yucca Mountain Repository in Nevada has become bogged down in what looks like a permanent political battle. Technologically speaking, we can safely store nuclear waste in a repository like that of Yucca Mountain. But why should we spend billions of dollars to bury what is actually billions of dollars worth of nuclear fuel, which could be supplying electricity in the years to come? The commercial reprocessing plant in Barnwell, South Carolina, shut down in 1977, but we could start reprocessing at the national nuclear facilities in Hanford in Washington State and at Savannah River in South Carolina, and we could have a crash program to develop more advanced technologies for reprocessing. This article was written by Majorie Hecht, and in here there's a chart that says that is about the estimated electrical energy from the different fuels that we do use to get electricity from, the world does. Hardwood, okay, this is how much 1 kilogram of these fuels will produce these many kilowatts. Hardwood, 1 kilogram of hardwood will produce 1 kilowatt hour. Coal, 3 kilograms of coal will produce, 1 kilogram of coal will produce 3 kilowatt hours. 1 kilogram of heavy oil will produce 4 kilowatt hours. 1 kilogram of natural gas will generate 6 kilowatt hours. Now these are very small numbers, 1, 3, 4, and 6. And these are the heavy ones that we use in the United States.
Mr. Nelson, I'm going to have to be, we're at the end of our allotted time here.
Okay.
I think what I'm going to have to ask you to, could you do this? Would you please bring it to a conclusion?
Yep.
And what I would suggest is you could provide us a citation to the article that you're referencing. And again, I apologize, but our hearing was scheduled from 7 to 9, and we
okay.
passed that. So,
all right.
Thank you.
Yep. One more minute, please.
Okay. Yep. Okay.
Natural uranium, 50,000 kilowatts per kilogram. Versus the 1, 2, 3 in coal. Low enriched uranium, 250,000 kilowatts. Uranium with reprocessing. If we did real reprocessing and used up all the waste, 3,500,000 kilowatts per kilogram. You know how much a kilogram is? It's a few pounds. 3 million. And we're messing around with coal that's not 3 million per kilogram. And all these other countries are using nuclear. There's nothing wrong with, you know, different sources of fuel and energy. But let's face the facts. We need to produce a lot of energy very cheaply to where we don't need to meter it because it costs too much to meter it. Let's just provide it free to the public. And you get it back in other things. But nuclear energy is the way of the future. And in this book also, there is an article that has a plan for 6,000 of these 1,000 megawatt plants to be put up in the world. Let's worry about the world and not just South Dakota. Thank you. Okay. Steve Nelson. Thank you very much for having this public hearing. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. And if you want to leave either the magazine or a cite to it, and then we'll have it for the record. Or you can submit, I'm trying to think if the comment period ends tomorrow, you know, but if you want to get us a copy. Okay. Thank you. Yep. Thank you. I think it appears that everybody out in the audience, other than the people who have been here for the last week, have testified. I'm assuming that no one who's been here for days and days probably wants to say anything. Mr. Rolfus, did you want to say anything? Okay. I think that was a joke. What I'd like to do on behalf of the commission is, is that your son? Does he want us to give a speech? Okay. I'd like to thank everyone for coming. I really would on behalf of the commissioners. I know they really appreciate hearing what y'all think out there. And again, we've got a very tough decision to make. The commissioners do. I don't get to make it. I got to point out one thing, and again, it's a constraint that you may or may not be aware of under our law. Our siting law statute requires us to render a decision within 1 year, and that may or may not have been a wise choice that the legislature made, but it is the one they made. So we've got to live within that. And I just want you and all the people on the internet to know that it's not the commissioner's decision here to rush this decision. It's what they've been commanded to do by the elected representatives of this state. And so, we've got to live within that. Thank you. The year is up. We are legally required to render a decision on or before July 21st, of this year. And so it's a tough timetable. It really is. And it's unfortunate that the federal EIS process can't be coordinated a little better with our decision-making process. The fact is, though, we've got to live within the reality that we have, and that's what it is. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Koster, and I think the commissioners are aware of that, although they are bound by the Administrative Procedures Act and by the South Dakota law of evidence and our statute. And if they determine that that's the right choice to make on the record that we have, that's their decision to make, and I think they are aware of that potential. And thank you. Yep. Again, I want to thank you all for coming.